All right, good afternoon.
Thank you for being here. If you couldn't get a ticket to any of the other events, this one requires no ticket. We have a couple of announcements, and then we will have Gordon Brown with us, who is the, as you know, the UN Special Envoy for Global Education, and he will brief you on his Global Education Initiative. Sorry. According to the latest update from the World Health Organization, the total number of cases in the current Ebola outbreak is 6,263 cases and 2,917 deaths. World leaders, as you know, are meeting as we speak at the invitation of the Secretary General to contain and stop the spread of the virus, treat those who are infected, ensure essential services, preserve stability, and prevent outbreaks in other countries. The Secretary General said there is overwhelming international political momentum for the United Nations to play a leading role in coordinating the global outbreak to the response, to the global response to the outbreak, excuse me. He added that we will play this role and meet this challenge. The Secretary General said that within 24 hours of a call for staff to deploy, the United Nations had received over 4,000 applications. The President of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone are participating either by teleconference or in person. Other participants include U.S. President Obama, the President of the World Bank, representatives of Médecins Sans Frontières, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, among others. Dr. Chan, Dr. Nabarro, and Anthony Banbury, the head of the UN response mission, will be at 1 p.m. at the stakeout on the ground floor between conference room 1 and 2, and they will also be joined by British actor Idris Elba, who, as you may know, whose father is from Sierra Leone before emigrating to the UK, and Idris Elba will speak of his commitment to supporting the global Ebola outbreak, response to the outbreak. This morning, the Secretary General also spoke at an event bringing together his Millennium Development Goals advocacy group. The group, co-chaired by the President of Rwanda and the Prime Minister of Norway, comprises of eminent personalities who are leaders in promoting the MDGs in areas such as education and women's empowerment. The Secretary General said we can be proud of what we've achieved in fighting poverty and improving health, education, and gender parity. But he also said that within 462 days until the deadline of reaching the MDGs, we must do more to achieve our targets on hunger, child malnutrition, child and maternal mortality, as well as access to sanitation. And the Secretary General also just spoke at an event on the post-2015 development agenda. On Libya, high-level on Libya meeting on Libya earlier today, the Secretary General said the country's political transition process is facing its biggest challenges since the 2011 revolution. Speaking to high-level delegates, the Secretary General noted that the past 12 months had seen unprecedented violence between rival armed factions. So far, more than 300,000 people have been displaced. Airports, government buildings, and other vital infrastructure have been destroyed, and hospitals do not have adequate medical supplies. The Secretary General added that although most international missions, including the UN support mission in Libya, have been temporarily relocated from the country, his special representative, Bernardo León, will continue to shuttle between the parties in Libya to promote dialogue as the only way out of the crisis. And from South Sudan, right now, the Secretary General will be speaking at a high-level meeting on South Sudan and will issue his remarks as soon as possible. And we also expect Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, Hervé Latsous, to go to the stakeout on the first floor after that meeting to speak to you. From Geneva, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, condemned the brutal, cold-blooded slaying by ISIL of Iraqi human rights defender Samira Salih Ali al-Nuaimi, who was publicly executed by a massed firing squad in central Mosul earlier this week. He also condemned the continuing detention, sexual exploitation, and sale of hundreds of women and girls in areas captured by the extremist groups. Human rights officials with the UN mission in Iraq have received numerous other reports of executions of women in Mosul and other areas controlled by the extremist groups. After perfunctory trials, educated professional women seem to be particularly at risk. The High Commissioner also expresses deep dismay at the situation facing hundreds of captured Yazidi women and girls, as well as some other ethnic and religious groups who have reportedly been sold into slavery, forced into marriage, and repeatedly raped by fighters since their homes were overrun in August. Today, the arms treaty marks a milestone. It has received 50 ratifications needed to enter into force, which is now set for December. In his message today, the Secretary General said that in adopting the Arms Trade Treaty, member states have come together to support a robust, legally binding commitment to provide a measure of hope to millions of people around the world. Adopted in April of last year by the General Assembly, the landmark treaty aims to regulate international trade in conventional arms. Three appointments by the Secretary General today. He has appointed Nicholas Haysom of South Africa as his special representative and head of the UN mission in Afghanistan. And Mr. Haysom, as you know, succeeds Jan Kubisch. The Secretary General has also appointed Carol Wainaina of Kenya as Assistant Secretary General for Human Resources Management in the Department of Management, and she succeeds Catherine Pollard. And lastly, in the third appointment is a joint appointment by the Secretary General and the African Union Commission Chairperson. They have appointed Abdul Kamara of Sierra Leone as the Deputy Joint Special Representative for the African Union Hybrid Operation Mission in Darfur. Mr. Kamara succeeds Joseph Mutatoba of Rwanda. One more thing, just a statement on the passing of a dear colleague of ours. The Secretary General learned with profound sadness of the passing yesterday of Margaret Vogt, who served as his special representative in the Central African Republic from 2011 to 2013. The Secretary General pays tribute to Ms. Vogt's long and rich career in the UN, the African Union, and academia. He recalls that Ms. Vogt was known for her tireless work, unmatched kindness, and incredible courage she displayed in the many dangerous duty stations she served. The Secretary General salutes Ms. Vogt's leadership, including during very turbulent times in Somalia and the Central African Republic. She saved lives, inspired others, brought joy to those she met. Her many friends, colleagues, and admirers in the UN and elsewhere will always remember her profound decency and humanity. The Secretary General conveys his deepest condolences to Ms. Vogt's family. Some of you may remember her. She served in the Department of Political Affairs for a long time and was often a guest in this room, and we are indeed saddened by her passing. Press encounters today, busy time, as you know. 12:20, Kim Semples Barrow, the First Lady of Belize and Special Envoy for Women and Children, will speak at the stakeout on the first floor. Also, as I mentioned, 1 p.m., the Ebola stakeout with Dr. Chan, Dr. Nabarro, Anthony Banbury, and Idris Elba. 2 p.m., I also mentioned Hervé Latsous on South Sudan. 6 p.m. at the Security Council stakeout, Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius of France, Foreign Minister José Antonio Cubreña of Mexico will brief reporters following the meeting of framing the veto in the event of mass atrocities. And tomorrow we will have another series of press conferences for you. Questions before we go, Mr. Brown? Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask about two things. One is about readouts generally, the one that was made yesterday, and also about how press conferences are done in this room. First is about in Ecuador. We had a press conference by the foreign minister of Ecuador last night, and he listed the issues that he said he raised to Mr. Ban, including the Julian Assange WikiLeaks case, including transnational corporations. But as I was sitting here, having heard him said that, I got the readout, and it talked about climate change and Ebola. So I wanted to know, how should we understand these readouts? Are they – do they list what the interlocutor thinks is important or what the Secretary General thinks is important?
Well, I mean, they are readouts put out by the Secretary General's office. So as always – the interlocutor may feel the need to put out a different readout. They are not transcripts of the meetings. They are not a laundry list of everything that was discussed. They are a reflection of what the Secretary General's office feels were the main points that were discussed, which in the meeting were Ebola and climate change. It doesn't mean that other things weren't discussed or that the interlocutor may have brought up other issues, but they are a reflection of how the meeting went from our side.
And the other one I wanted to ask was earlier in this week, there was an 11 a.m. press conference by the President of France, François Hollande. Then it was canceled. I happened to be here, and actually then the room filled up with journalists, mm-hmm. and they said it's been reserved. And I think you may have been back there. So I just want to know, what are the rules for this room? Can a country throw journalists that are not from their country out of the room? How did that happen?
There was a mix-up due in part from our office. If it's a public press conference, everybody is invited. Missions sometimes ask to use the room to brief their traveling press. We accommodate them. It's a member state-run organization if they wish to use the room. We ask them that if they do a briefing for only their traveling press, that we don't publicize it, and we don't. There was a mix-up yesterday because things were done last minute.
Has any other country done that during this GA?
Other countries have, but as I said, it's a private use of this room. Yes, it is. Yes, Evelyn.
Right. This is just my opinion as a veteran of the press corps. I have rarely seen such dreadful scheduling at the high-level event. This is not your fault. It's just something I would like you to take upstairs. You can't have three summits in one day and expect anyone to cover them.
You know,
the climate thing all over the place rather than focusing it.
Yeah. Evelyn, we feel your pain. It's a lot for you to cover. It's an enormous amount for us to organize. It's the Secretary General, I think, if he could be cloned into three people, could probably not cover everything. He had 27 engagements yesterday, I think 28, something like that, the day before. Some engagements he sends his deputy or has messages read out. The problem is that we live in a turbulent time. World leaders gather only once a year here. We have to take advantage of their presence. So.
No, Steph, it was the worst that I could remember.
It's also,
the UN staff is the one I feel sorry for, because they cannot cope with the amount of registration.
I appreciate
and minders and everything else.
I appreciate it, but South Sudan, Somalia, Ebola, climate change—these are all issues that need to be dealt with. And you know,
no need to have three summits in one day.
I think it depends on your point of view. Yes, Sarah.
Follow up to what Evelyn said, I have to agree on some of those points because we've had photo ops. We had photo ops that were scheduled for the 38th, and we have to be screened half an hour in advance, and then we get up to the 38th, and they run us back down to GA 200. The Secretary General actually had to apologize to the Prime Minister of Japan for running him up and down the stairs.
You know, I hear your pain. I think we all have to bear and grin through it. It happens once a year for 2 weeks. It's the madness. I happen to love it. It's a lot of work for everybody, but, I register your complaint. Do you have a question?
My question is, yes. Yeah. My question is, how does the UNDPI decide who gets to be listed as a wire service and who doesn't?
You know what? I think that's a question you can address to my colleague in Malu. Okay. Well, then we can. Okay. Okay. Well, it's a question I'm not capable of answering right now, Mr. Lee.
I wanted to add two things. I wanted to ask one. Yesterday evening, the speech by the President of Sri Lanka, Mahinda Rajapaksa, specifically took issue with the Human Rights Council inquiry, which I know has come up in this room before. And they've said that they're not going to give visas for it, and they reject it. And I wonder, I mean, in the past, when these statements have been made from Sri Lanka, from this podium, you've been willing to say, or Farhan has said, that the Secretary General stands behind the panel and it should get in. Will you respond to this speech, or is it different?
I think we're not going to respond to the more than 193 speeches that are made because people speak in different fora here. But the Secretary General's position on the human rights inquiry is unchanged. Yes, ma'am, in the back. And then we'll get Mr. Brown.
Hi, Stefan. I just wanted to ask because the Secretary General said yesterday he called for a review of the peace operations. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us exactly what would be the extent or the scope of this review and what points will be taken up? Thank you.
Yeah, I think, the Secretary General's feeling is that it's been 15 years since the landmark Brahimi review on peacekeeping. What he plans to do is to take a look at not only peacekeeping operations, but also special political missions and the challenges that we're facing. I think the challenges that we faced 15 years ago have changed. They're multifaceted, the issue of terror groups, the issue of resources for peacekeeping are challenging. And so it will be a wholesale review and look forward to how we do peacekeeping. And as I answer my question, I see my guest has sat comfortably, but I think, Mr. Brown, if you don't mind coming up here to take some questions, and we will get underway. Well, we're delighted to be joined by the Secretary General's Special Envoy for Global Education, Gordon Brown. Sir, you have the floor.
Welcome. Thank you for coming, those who have managed to be here this morning and those who are listening on the webcast. I think we're seeing today, if I may sum up what I see happening, almost every problem that is being dealt with at the UN this week, whether it's Ebola or whether it's the whole issue of the Middle East, or whether it's climate change, where we've had a massive demonstration, people are recognizing these are global problems that require global solutions and require a degree of international coordination that in the past has not always been there. And I want to specifically refer to the Campaign for Global Education and what I do as UN envoy. And here again, this is a global problem, 58 million children not at school, half a billion girls who will never finish school, millions of young people denied the opportunity to get to college or university despite having the talent to do so. And this is a global problem that cannot be solved without mobilizing the resources of the whole world. What I find fascinating is in the last 2 years, we are not only seeing governments recognizing the importance of education to their economic development, but we're seeing what I think is the most interesting phenomenon of all. We're seeing the emergence of a youth movement of young girls and boys, teenagers, students, who are no longer prepared to accept that the denial of opportunity that they've experienced is something that is inevitable. And I think people will look back 100 years from now and see a global civil rights struggle underway. Girls determined that they will not be forced into early marriage. Girls and boys determined to fight child labor, which is denying them the opportunity of education and forcing them into jobs that in many ways are unsafe, and trafficking, which of course is one of the problems that you do need global coordinated action to deal with. And I just want to explain this by way of one illustration that I think will be of interest to everybody here. Today, the parents of the 215 girls who were kidnapped in Nigeria, in Borno State, are considering whether they should organize funerals for the girls who were abducted. A Nigerian custom that if people are missing for 4 months or more, then closure is required, funerals take place, a period of mourning happens. And this, tragically, is what is happening to parents in Nigeria that have given up hope that the children may be returned to them. And we've seen, of course, since April the 14th, 215 girls who were kidnapped, abducted. Some girls escaped. 15 of these girls have now gone back to school. Many more in Nigeria of the girls who escaped are refusing to go back to school because they don't think the schools are safe. And many thousands of girls and boys in the north of Nigeria are not going to school at all because they do not feel that they are properly protected against terrorism. Now, I believe there is hope for these girls. I believe all the information we have is that they're likely to be alive. I believe that the government, and I think it has been unfairly criticized, is doing everything in its power to see whether they can recover these girls safely, particularly since the girls have been split up, as I understand it, into a number of different groups, and to rescue one group would put the other groups at risk. But I also believe that the government's proposal for a safe schools initiative is a way forward, not just for Nigeria, but for many other countries after what has been a summer of carnage involving children in so many different areas of the world where they've been put at risk, where the schools have been bombed, where they want to get back into education, but they want to have safe schools. So in Nigeria, we are sponsoring, me as a UN Special Envoy, the business community, the government, a whole range of international organizations, a major safe school initiative to fortify the schools, to give them the telecommunications that will enable them to have prior warning of any terrorist threat, to enable children and parents to feel that the schools will be safe in the future. And this idea of safe schools is not only important to Nigeria, but it's important in the regions of the Middle East, where children are in danger, where schools in some cases have begun theaters of war rather than sanctuaries for children pursuing their education. And it's important also in Syria and in Lebanon and in Jordan, where we need to do something for the million and more child refugees who are now without education in a country, Syria, where 100% of children used to be in education, but today only 20% of children who are Syrian children are in education, whether it's in Syria, in Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, or some of the surrounding areas. So I want to put before you today the proposal that we have been discussing in the international community about investing in safe schools as well as in the right of children to education. I want to tell you that we are on the final push to ensure that every child is at school to meet the Millennium Development Goal. I want to tell you also we met important countries who are trying to meet that Millennium Development Goal, and they're now setting targets that will enable them to have 100% enrollment by the end of 2015. And I'm also meeting the countries that are far behind in meeting the Millennium Development Target, and we're drawing up plans with them so that they can achieve the Millennium Development Target as quickly as possible. 58 million children not in school, 22 million of these in conflict areas, 32 million of these are girls. Many of them are people who are working, 14 million in child labour, 10 million girls married off every year as child brides. And you can see that to solve the problem of universal education, we need also to take action against child marriage, we need to take action against child labour, and to take action against child trafficking. I just want to end on this and then invite any questions. When I say there is a civil rights struggle underway, and people will look back on the movements that are taking place around the world, embryonic in some countries, of girls, boys, and young people, they will compare them, in my view, to some of the civil rights struggles of the past. In Bangladesh today, girls are joining with other girls to form child marriage-free zones. And they are saying that they will refuse to allow themselves to be married off as schoolgirls against their will, and that they want to complete their education. And if they are forced, even by their parents, into a marriage they do not want, they will bind together as girls and support and defend each other. And these child marriage-free zones are one example of this civil rights struggle. They are now expanding into India and into Pakistan. There are now proposals for child marriage-free zones in many of the countries of Africa. But that is just one example of a freedom fight on behalf of and with and organized by young people themselves, and sometimes more aggressively pursuing the interests of children's rights than adults who are supposed to discharge them on behalf of children. The Global March Against Child Labour, young people in almost every country in the Indian subcontinent, but also in Africa, refusing to accept that they either should be trafficked or sent down mines or working in insanitary conditions in workshops or working as domestic servants. And the Global March, as it is called, the March Against Child Labour, is organising a conference on these slave labour conditions in the next few weeks. And the global movement is taking off both in that area and in the area of child trafficking. So I can point to huge progress in the fight to ensure universal education. I can point to people beginning to understand that no solution for universal education can be successful without dealing with the problems of children in conflict. And I can point to the evidence that shows that no solution will happen without dealing with the problems of child labour, child trafficking, and child marriage. But the great opportunity before us is if we can deliver universal education, and if we can make schooling compulsory, if we can raise what is a very small sum of money, $6 billion, over the next year, in addition to resources already committed, and can actually move to universality in most of the countries of the world, then we will not only have achieved an end to educational exclusion. Compulsory education will mean, as it meant in the West in the last century, an end to child labour, child marriage, child trafficking, and that is the prize that is before us. I'm very happy to answer any questions, but you can see that there is huge progress here, but we have to fight even harder over the next few months if we are to meet this second Millennium Development Goal and become the first generation in history where every single child is at school. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister, and some would say most recently the hero of Scotland. I welcome you on behalf of the United Nations Correspondent Association. I'm Evelyn Leopold.
I know of you, and I know of your work, so it's nice to see you.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. I have two questions. One is, how do you educate young men attracted to Boko Haram or ISIS in telling them that religion is not an should not be used as an excuse for rape, whether it's forced marriage or just obscene sexual harassment? And secondly, in addition to your projects, how do you convince governments who are not in a conflict area to invest more in education rather than military means? Is it using examples like you mentioned in India and other countries, or it seems to be a very, very difficult task?
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I am here as a Member of Parliament in the United Kingdom, and it is still the United Kingdom after the events of last week. Perhaps I can answer both questions together by giving you one example of a visit I had recently to Abuja in Nigeria and to a small school just outside the capital town of Abuja in that great country. And I arrived at this school, which is a dilapidated building, falling apart, corrugated iron roofs, no computers, not even desks in most of the classroom, kids having to sit on the floor. And I arrived there to look around the school, and funnily enough, just as I arrived, Bono, for some reason, arrived as well, except he arrived with a flotilla of cameras and people reporting his visit. And we went into this classroom, and we talked to the kids there. And as you do, you ask kids what they want to be. And so some wanted to be scientists, doctors, teachers, lawyers. Some wanted to be engineers and airline pilots, everything that you can think of. Nobody wanted to be a politician, by the way. Nobody actually, to Bono's surprise, wanted to be a pop singer either. And I think he was rather taken aback by that. But the story was, this school was losing pupils at a very fast rate to a madrasas that had been created very near, had huge investment put in it from donations that had come from outside Nigeria, was attracting by offering free education in the best of circumstances with the facilities that our aid had denied that school that I was visiting. And so you are seeing a pattern emerge where if we do not provide the investment that is necessary for the education of these children, and the aid in education to sub-Saharan Africa, let me tell you, is $12 per child per year, which means almost enough only to purchase a textbook rather than to purchase an education. If we do not provide the aid for investment in education in these countries, including some of the richer countries in Africa, like Nigeria, then it is clear that there are terrorist groups that are prepared to invest in education for indoctrination and for propaganda and for creating a new generation of terrorist fighters. And so my answer to your question is that, one, young people want opportunity. It is a myth to assume that they want to be part of terrorist organizations. They want opportunity. They want to realize their potential. They want to have the same sort of jobs that people are talking about here when they're young, and that is their ambitions. We have to answer their call for opportunity by delivering resources that make it possible for every child in the African subcontinent, African sub-Saharan part of Africa, to get a decent education. If we don't do that, then it is clear that we will pay a price when there are other organizations with extremist views, easily counteractable if we were in a position to make the investment that is necessary. But these will attract young people if we are not prepared to make the investment that should be made in the education of a child. And I say to you, $12 per child. Nobody can say that this is profligate aid. Nobody can say that this is money likely to be wasted. We should be spending far more on the education of a child as aid from the collective of donors than $12 a child in sub-Saharan Africa. And I just go to almost every part of Africa and the Middle East, and I see projects that are there, planned. There are people ready to run them, but there is not the money to be provided. I just give you one final example in Syria. Children who have left Syria as refugees, now in Lebanon. There are now 500,000 children in Lebanon as refugees, as exiles. The Lebanese government, to its credit, is offering to provide school places as a double shift in existing schools. They have the staff who are ready to be employed to do it, some of them former Syrian teachers. We have drawn up a plan with the international community, including UNICEF and others, to provide that education. We cannot provide school places this week as school returns for these Lebanese children who are refugees in Syria because the international aid community has not enough money to deliver that project. So for, in some cases, $5 a week, at the maximum $13 a week, we could provide education today for nearly 400,000 children who at present are out of school in Lebanon, but we have not been able to marshal the resources that are necessary, around $200 million a year. We've marshaled less than half of that to enable this to happen. So again, you've got young people in Lebanon who are Syrian refugees who are prey to trafficking, child marriage, child labor, but also prey to being recruited by terrorist organizations. And this is a failure on our part to provide the investment that is necessary for the future.
Thank you. Mr. Prime Minister, will you or Malala travel to Nigeria to participate in this funeral ceremony to put a sharper focus on this event?
No, I do not want the funerals to take place. I know it is a custom that if someone is missing for 4 months, that a service is organized in, as a memorial service and the equivalent of a funeral. But I have hope that these girls will be returned to their parents. I have hope that what the government in Nigeria is doing with the international community makes us in a position to locate these girls. I know the difficulties that any, from being a leader myself, I know the security problems that arise when you know that some girls are in one part of the country and others are in other part of the country, and to rescue one group may put at risk the rest. So I know the dilemmas and the difficulties, and I know from talking to President Goodluck Jonathan and the Finance Minister Ngozi, whom I met yesterday, that they are doing everything in their power to try to locate but also to try and rescue the girls. And I know, too, that if we are going to solve this problem and prevent people being terrorized by a small organization, which Boko Haram is, then we need to have safer schools and we need to invest in them. So I am hoping that we can persuade the parents that there is hope, even in what may seem the most hopeless situation. I know also, some of you may have also may also know this, that things can never return to normal for these girls, because of the 215 girls who were kidnapped, seven families have lost a parent who have died since these girls were kidnapped. So even if the girls are returned to their parents, there are some who will find that their father or their mother is now dead. And of course, some of that may be due to the strain that these families were experiencing. So this is a tragic situation, but the answer is that we need to have safer schools as well as do everything we can to rescue the girls.
Roger Hamilton-Martin, IPS. Could you talk a little bit about how the money that you've asked for is going to be spent?
The money for Nigeria or the money for Lebanon? Lebanon?
The 6 billion.
The 6 billion. Oh, yeah. Some of you may not realize that in some countries, the cost of educating a child per year is $100. In other countries, $200. It's partly a reflection of the lack of investment that's been made in schools. It's partly the salaries paid to teachers. And it's partly, the lower costs of providing education in some countries. So it is not an expensive project to get a large number of children into school. It is possible to do this. Equally, when we talk about health, medical advances, and making health innovations available to people in Africa and elsewhere, you're usually talking about expensive projects, and sometimes you're talking about medical innovation that is yet to happen and technology that is yet to be developed for a particular strain of disease or a particular country and its unique characteristics. Again, in education, we know what needs to be done. There is no technological breakthrough needed. There is no scientific innovation we're waiting for, so we can move ahead very quickly. So there is no reason why you cannot build school classrooms and construct schools, and there's no reason why you cannot hire teachers who are already trained, who are available to do the teaching, and there's no reason, therefore, why we cannot move very quickly over the next few months and get children to school. I've been talking to countries that are behind on the Millennium Development Goals, and how they can actually achieve 100% universal enrollment by the end of 2015. And I mean talking about the countries that are far behind about how they can devise plans that they could implement quickly with a timetable to deliver faster enrollments and deliver, of course, better education for children who are in school at the moment. So this is a feasible proposition. The $6 billion would be additional money to what the international community has offered already. It would be money that would have to be raised either from donor countries or from the countries themselves, the Pakistans and the Nigerians, where they are behind in terms of enrollment. They would have to spend more in education. So the $6 billion is not necessarily aid money. It is potentially business, philanthropic, foundation money, government money, international agency money, and domestic government money in these countries. But it shows that with a limited amount of money, we can actually achieve a huge amount to give every child opportunity.
Please use your microphone.
Thank you so much. Sorry for this. Mr. Prime Minister, my name is Irene Hell. I report for British and German media.
German, yeah, okay.
Mr. Prime Minister, you've been very, very successful in making education a major new Millennium Development Goal. Your ambitions are high, so you want to see every kid in the world in school, which is wonderful. So this $6 billion you're talking about, is it enough to put every kid in school? And the second question is, you've been advocating very successfully as a politician navigating the world stage. So the goals achieved so far on this road to having every child in school, what are the biggest victories so far you could achieve? Thank you.
I think when the international community in the first decade of this century achieved debt relief for the poorest countries, we allowed these countries to spend money on education. So I remember in Kenya, at one weekend, 1 million children were queuing up to register for school. So we have had major victories in Uganda, Kenya, Ghana, countries where as a result of either debt relief or a special measure, as a result, about 40 million extra children have gone to school. So this has been a progress. But it is possible, and some of it does not involve money. You know, getting a child to school who is at the moment working, sometimes illegally, but working full-time instead of being at school, is not an additional cost in any real sense for the taxpayer. It is a huge benefit to get that child out of labour and into the school. And again, if we stop girls being married off at 12, 13, 14, then these girls will be at school and these girls will benefit from existing classrooms. It's the rural areas and the remote areas where, of course, much of the new investment's got to take place. But again, although in the long run you will want to build traditional schools, in the short run you can do one hut schools, one classroom huts, if you like, where you can bring in, as the BRAC organization in Bangladesh does, these temporary constructions with a teacher or two teachers to get these children in rural areas into school. I mean, it is not an impossible task. It's an engineering task. It doesn't require some breakthrough, as I've said, and it doesn't require these substantial sums of money that people usually have to talk about elsewhere. Over the long term, if you want to improve the quality of education to the level we want, you've got to recognize that if the average expenditure on a pupil in Africa is $100 and the average expenditure on a pupil in America is for the time that they're at school about $5,000 a year, then you will spend $100,000 on the education of an American child from 0 to 16, and probably because it's an average of 4 years you do education in Africa, in some countries only $400. So the disparity is still enormous. And we have got to bridge that gap between the inequality of opportunity available in Africa with $400 spent on your education as against $100,000 in America. But in the short term, you can get people into school, as we should, to meet the Millennium Development Goal. And I say that once children go to school and once they have the freedom and the right to do so, it is a right that they will not, and certainly their parents will not want to surrender. So once it's established, it is very difficult for governments to go back in it and go back to the old days.
Great.
Okay.
Julia, maybe one last question. Good afternoon. Thank you for the briefing. My name is Julia Sibye. I'm working for Al Hayat. I'm actually also a junior at New York University Abu Dhabi, an institution I know you're involved in, an institution that hopes to change the paradigm of higher education. And so my question for you is, how do you see the paradigm of education at all levels changing? And secondly, what role can technology play in providing education for all? Thank you.
Well, I think you've answered your very brilliant question with the second part of it, that technology is obviously going to be a huge enabler for educational opportunity. And we've got a major project with all the top technology companies and with people who have got inspirational ideas about free online education to see whether we can help to meet the massive demand for education and for information and knowledge in countries which simply cannot quickly provide universities, colleges, or in some cases, even primary secondary schools. So free online education and making it attractive for students, but not ignoring the fact that just the dissemination of knowledge has got to be accompanied by proper tutoring, and that requires resources to do so. That is a very important way forward. And, of course, it changes the nature of a university. It changes the nature of a college. You're separating teaching from tutoring, or lecturing from tutoring, from sometimes from certification, sometimes from research work. So I see this as being a revolution in the way that university education and college education will be organized in the future. But the key thing for a child in a remote area, if they can be linked up to the internet, then they can have access to the libraries of the world. They can have the best lecturers available talking to them from whatever university the student chooses to gain his or her knowledge. Of course, you need resources for the tutoring element, but it does potentially transform the way education is delivered for the future. We're in an exciting period where if we use technology properly, then the degree and extent of the extension of opportunity to some of the poorest and most marginalized students is going to be transformative. So I think meeting the Millennium Development Goals is our first task. Making possible quality education for every child is what follows immediately. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.